From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Midland, Texas, a town in a largely Christian state that is nonetheless far more Christian than the average. So you might imagine it would be difficult to be growing up in Midland as the only Russian immigrant, an awkward girl whose last name is Hebrew. If you were that girl, your classmates might consider you to be weird. You might struggle to make friends or fit in or find a date or get invited to parties. You would be Olga Hazan. Olga is now a staff writer for The Atlantic, and she's the author of a book called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. The book is a collection of stories about people who are, yes, weird. And Olga wants to reclaim that word in a way that makes it not a pejorative, but a kind of celebration, a celebration of strengths. The people she meets and the historical figures she describes are people who took more difficult paths to find happiness or success. Their stories stitch together to create a powerful theme. And Hazan ties it together with research and expert analysis. It can be hard to be weird. It can be hard to look at social norms, shrug, and say, nope, I'm not going to do that. Society makes norm breakers pay a price. So how can people who are weird find ways to advance their ideas without being shut down or ostracized? My favorite idea is called idiosyncrasy credits. It can help all of us, as our guest will explain. Hazan notes that in group discussion experiments, people rate those who agree with the average sentiment of a group highly. They reject those who disagree with the group. And this is true even if the group believes something rather obviously awful. For example, black people should not marry white people. The power of groupthink is so strong that sometimes it takes great courage to change it. This hour, a conversation about what it means to be weird and what we can learn from Olga Hazan's powerful new book. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic and author of Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to start by asking you, when is the first time you remember thinking of yourself as weird?
I feel like kids used to call me weird all the time. I kind of started asking myself, well, am I weird or am I just a normal person who doesn't belong here?
You heard kids saying that out loud to you?
Yeah. Just because of what you said about being like a Russian immigrant in West Texas.
can you describe your parents for our listeners and a little bit of what life was like growing up for you?
Yeah, totally. So I was born in Russia. My parents are Russian. And in the late 80s, there was like a refugee resettlement program of Russian Jews to the U.S. And we were part of that program. So a bunch of Russian Jews came over at the same time, all in the late 80s. The U.S. government was sort of like, okay, you're here, you don't speak English, but we're going to put you with other Jews so that you'll feel kind of at home. And they did. They put us in Los Angeles, where there are lots of Jewish people. But pretty soon after that, my parents realized that the cost of living in Los Angeles was like not working for a new recent immigrant family. So my dad and my dad's employer approached him about moving with the company to West Texas, and my dad said yes. And that was also a way to get my mom was working at like McDonald's at the time. Also a way to get my mom back in a like professional job, which is what she had in Russia. That's how we ended up in West Texas. And the plan was just to stay there for a little while, but they are still in Texas, though not in West Texas.
Pretty Christian culture that you grew up in. And one of the things I want to talk about this hour is the pressure to conform and how difficult it can be. But I think it's important to define the word weird, because my understanding is that the many people you interviewed for this book, not all of them knew you were going to use that word at the title, or sometimes you didn't even use that word with them. You kind of talked about unique or different, because some people view it in pejorative terms. How do you see the word weird and how do you define it?
Yeah, so the criteria for the book, for the characters that I found in the book, was to be different from everyone else around them in some way. Weird is sort of you know, like shrill or whatever, all those books where it's like a bad word that's actually good. Weird is sort of like the pejorative term for people like that. But, you know, obviously I see it as a good thing. So, but the kinds of people who are in the book are sort of like the only liberal in a very conservative environment, the only person of their gender at their job, maybe the only person of their ethnicity or their race in their environment. So I wanted to kind of explore what it's like to be the only one. Everyone did know that the title would be weird before the book was published. I just want to be clear about that. Yeah. So, I didn't bring it on anyone.
But when we use that word this hour, I just want listeners to know that the author, our guest, uses it with affection, and I do too. I don't want people to think that it is used in a pejorative way, especially because for many people, it can be or has been a painful word. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, and I mean, most of the people that I talked to had a period where they were like, it is really hard being the only one. Like, I really believe in this, and I really want to be doing this. You know, I really want to be in this environment that I'm in, even though it's hard. But they definitely all had a period where it was like, people are judging me, they want me to conform, and it's difficult.
I want to read a little bit what you wrote about your parents in this regard, because you write that your Russian immigrant parents did not really assimilate much, that they ate Russian food, they watched Russian television shows, they were living in Texas, but they were essentially trying as best they could to still be living in Russia. And you wrote, quote, "I imagine this retreat to their homeland is, in part, a reaction to the alienation we experienced in Texas. In the Dallas suburbs, we had few negative experiences on account of our ethnicity, but we didn't have many especially positive ones either. I think this ennui soured my parents on American culture slightly and prompted them to look elsewhere for connection. You see a similar phenomenon with people who spend all their time LARPing. Yes, it's a reclusive, looked down upon subculture, but at least it's their subculture. When you find yourself in constant disagreement with the world, you withdraw into yourself. You rewatch old movies, wear your broken in pajamas. You move back mentally to a country you fled. When you are the only one of your kind, you just want to find your kind again," end quote. How much would your parents agree with that?
I think it's not possible to disagree with the fact that all they watch is Russian TV.
No, those are facts. Right?
That past fact check. I don't know. I don't know how much self-awareness they have about this, but to me, it's very clear that, you know, they have no friends. They really do not keep up with American pop culture. They don't read in English really for fun. It's just more pleasant. It's more comforting, you know, to kind of keep in touch with this culture that honestly, doesn't really exist anymore in the way that they knew it. You know, I'm thinking about like I am about my parents' age now when they immigrated. And like, if I moved to Russia right now, I would definitely keep watching American TV and movies. And, you know, I wouldn't switch over to, you know, in my 30s to consuming a different country's pop culture. So I kind of understand it, but I also think it's a purposeful choice of theirs not to assimilate.
So, and part of what I guess I assume about what your parents have experienced, this ambivalence, I thought that was a very interesting way to describe it, that it wasn't that there was consistent negative experiences living in the United States as Russian immigrants, but there really weren't positive experiences. They just sort of were there. They weren't ostracized, but they weren't embraced or loved or, sort of integrated in by the people around them. And I find that interesting, and I find myself thinking that it must have been what you would call a tight society. And I think it's important to hear you explain the difference between tight social groups and loose social groups, tight societies, looser societies, tight work cultures, looser work cultures. I found this so important and so instructive and helpful. So if you can explain for listeners sort of what you mean by that and then maybe offer some examples.
Yeah, so this is a theory. Tightness and looseness is a psychological concept that was developed by this psychologist named Michelle Gelfand. I just want to give her credit because I did not come up with this. Essentially, it says that there's sort of environments or societies or workplaces or what have you that have a lot of rules and those that don't have a lot of rules. And the ones with a lot of rules are considered basically tight. That means that there's just a specific way to do everything. There is a kind of a understood way that you're going to progress through this environment. There's a limited range of things that you're going to say. There's kind of a limited range of behaviors that are acceptable. So if you think about like the tightest societies, it's going to be like, the Amish or the military. Like, you don't get to choose your own uniform when you're in the military. You wear the one that everyone wears. So it's, you know, the rule is very explicit. If you think about a loose society, it's Burning Man, right? So like, you come and you build your weird art project, and maybe you're naked and maybe you're not, and maybe you're doing drugs and maybe I've never been to Burning Man, but from what I understand, everything goes, right? So people who don't fit in find it easier to be in those looser societies. Like, I know a lot of burners, and they tend to be people who like are not doing great at like the white collar, like the law firm or whatever, you know, like they find that experience a little bit awkward. So they go to Burning Man to like let their freak flag fly, you know? There's less kind of intense examples of that in different elements of life. So like, if you are someone who is not religious, I mean, yeah, you're going to have a harder time in a place where everyone's first question to you is, what church do you go to? Like, there's like a limited range of acceptable answers to that question. And if you're like, I actually don't go to church, I don't think there is a God, like, I think that will make it a little bit more difficult for you to fit into that society. So that's kind of what I'm talking about in the book, where I talk about tightness and looseness.
And that sounds like Midland, Texas. What did you say when people said, what church do you go to?
Well, eventually I started going to church, by myself, without my parents. Eventually I just said the church that I ended up going to, because it was everyone. Like, everyone was very, very religious. I don't think I really met a Democrat until college, or an adult Democrat. It's a tight place.
So when it comes to looser and tighter social groups, societies, towns, places, there are reasons for both. And I think there's probably a temptation for listeners to think, oh, well, I prefer this or I prefer that, and the other kind is bad. Well, I mean, we probably have preferences to live in either a looser or perhaps a tighter social group or society. But there are reasons, whether people realize it or not, for preferring one to the other. What are the reasons and the benefits, potentially, of tighter and looser?
Yeah, so I think like my natural inclination is to prefer the looser, but I will argue for the tight side. So I think that people in those environments, so I actually did interview a former Amish person for the book, and she kind of described it as a very stress-free life. Like, these people do not wake up and wonder how they're going to get their next promotion. They don't like constantly agonize about whether they should get married or whether they should have kids. Like, everything is kind of laid out for you. Like, you know exactly what you're going to do. You know exactly what's expected of you. You know roughly what kind of life you're going to have from a very early age. And it takes out a lot of that, like, indecision and anxiety and angst and, like, whose expectations should I be living up to? Am I living up to them? A lot of the indecision that I think people deal with in modern life, because we have become so diffuse and like you really can kind of choose your own adventure in so many different ways, like it can kind of be freeing to not have to deal with that. Like, it can kind of be, you know, or if you think about people who follow a special diet for religious purposes, it's kind of nice sometimes to not have to choose what you're going to eat, or like, you know, because you can only eat certain things. And I do think that that's like a strong argument for religion and for kind of like traditions and things like that, that, maybe the people on the looser side don't really uphold as much.
Yeah, and I share your preference for a looser society. I just find it, frankly, easier to be weird and to celebrate difference and to cultivate strengths and new ideas. But I understand the points you're making about why tighter societies and social groups form. And, you know, when you talk about a kind of social immune system, this seems to me to be much more prevalent in tighter social circles where people who are different, people who are weird, have a harder time because what is more common, what is the norm, is viewed as safer. And you've kind of described this as a social gag reflex. Tell me about, you know, how that develops and maybe why it develops, whether we realize it or not sometimes.
Yeah, so this is like a very, like an interesting line of research that basically suggests that historically, being conformist, being a tight society, has helped keep societies healthy, physically healthy. Because if you're doing everything a certain way that is already proven to be safe or clean or whatever else, you know, if you're like butchering the pigs in the right way or whatever, and you're, you know, you're only like mating with the people that everyone says it's okay to mate with, and you know, you're upholding all of the traditions in the exact right way, you're less likely to get STDs. You're less likely to get foodborne diseases. You're less likely to get, you know, pathogens that outsiders bring in who don't follow the same customs as you. You know, so kind of if you think about it ancestrally, it makes sense to kind of be wary of outsiders because you're like, oh man, if I change up what I'm doing, I might get sick. Like I might, you know, expose myself to diseases that I'm not ready for because I'm deviating from tradition. So this theory holds that like, because of this kind of like caveman-ish reflex, now when we meet people who are different from us or who we think are weird, we have kind of a negative reaction to them. We kind of think like, ooh, I don't know about that. I find that a little strange. Like I, you know, I'm not comfortable with that. I remember, this is a very random example, but when I was going to church a lot in high school, I would have these long, long, long evening sessions with my youth pastor where I would like bring up questions I had about the Bible and my youth pastor and his wife. And I would ask the wife in particular questions about like biblical womanhood and things like that. And I asked about like, there's a lot of like sex work in the Bible. It's just like, that was like part of life. And so I asked about sex work and like, well, you know, should prostitution be legal? And like, I've heard prostitution is legal in, you know, the Netherlands and maybe it should be legal here. And like, look, here it appears in the Bible. And I remember she had a very negative reaction to that. She was like, oh my God, if prostitution is legal in the Netherlands, I never want to go there. That's disgusting to me. Like, this is like, that's so gross. And like, you know, to me, that is like looking back, like a little bit of an example of a behavioral immune reaction, because you're thinking prostitution isn't part of my culture. Prostitution is this weird, loose, like thing that people are doing. I think it could spread diseases and I don't want any part of it. And you kind of like push that away, you know? You know, I think that is sort of all part of how we evaluate weirdness, you know, as we kind of go through life.
Sure, and I'm not seeking to insinuate that everyone has, you know, is a xenophobe or is, you know, phobic in different ways. But there are some tendencies we have in certain moments, and one of the really interesting things is that apparently research backs up is that if you are a woman who can bear children, the most xenophobic and the most ethnocentric you will ever be in your life is during the first trimester of pregnancy. Why is that?
Because that is when you are uniquely vulnerable to infection. And so you are trying even harder than normal to avoid getting sick. So during that time, I mean, the way we most often see it is like women start get morning sick, right? And that's like a way of like expelling the, you know, yeah. Things. But also they're, you know, they kind of start to avoid, you know, exhibit these ethnocentric and xenophobic attitudes, according to research, more so than normal, because you're like, I just want to stay away from anything that could hurt me, because it's a vulnerable time.
So talking to Olga Hazan, whose book is called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and I thought the book was so important. Listeners, if you've got thoughts to share about weirdness, either how you think of yourself, maybe how it impacted you when you were younger, how you view it now, or maybe your kids, what they're going through, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And if you want to add to the growing pile of emails on the subject, you can email connections@WXXI.org. And so when you think about being someone in a place where you are the only one of that kind, or of that political stripe, or of that, all kinds of different, that's what this book is about. It's people who are essentially the only one in their space. And there is was a college professor, you talk about being the only Democrat, you know, or the only progressive. Can you tell us the story that leads to a concept called idiosyncrasy credits, which I think was the most valuable idea I've heard in a long time?
Yeah. Okay. So I love this idea too. And basically, okay. So this college professor, Beverly, that I interviewed, is a college professor. There's like a lot of Texans in the book, and I did not mean it that way, or I didn't design it that way from the start. It just kind of happened that way. She is also in Texas. So she's in Wichita Falls, Texas, which is, at the time that I wrote this book, it was the most conservative congressional district in the entire country. And she is she teaches sociology. She considers herself a Democrat, and she also, the kind of sociology she teaches is like about parasexuality, like sort of like people who do camming online, and like you know, different types of like sexuality that's outside the norm. So she's like weird in a lot of different ways is what I'm trying to say. So she brings this like gender studies, like sociology, liberalness with her to Wichita Falls. And when she's first teaching her classes, people start pushing back on kind of some of what she's saying. Like, you know, the kids are not really eager to hear about feminism or you know, the gender pay disparity. And she, you know, people, you know, it might not matter that much, but like it matters if you're a college professor, if your message is getting through. So kids start kind of shutting down, you know, responding with like, did you hear that on CNN? You know, kind of like, and this
CNN,
kind of,
yeah.
Right. Like kind of, you know, just like dismissing it out of hand. And so what she decides to do is basically idiosyncrasy credits. And let me just describe what she did first. So what she does is essentially change up her class, where she kind of gently gets everyone into the groove before she starts heavy hitting with like talking about feminism or whatever else. So she'll spend like the first entire half of the class now on men and masculinity. Just to show that men can be a part of gender studies too, and like part of learning about gender is about learning about masculinity. And so she doesn't lose all of these like, you know, dudes from Wichita Falls right away. You know, and so she, you know, she kind of like, if someone says like, oh, well, what you're saying doesn't fit my personal experience, she'll say like, yeah, that's, you know, that might be right, but what you have is an anecdote, and that's different from aggregate data, and here's the difference, and here's how researchers, you know, think about that. So she kind of, I don't know, I don't really love this phrase, but she kind of met them where they're at, so to speak. And this is idiosyncrasy credits. It's basically like, if you're kind of a unique person, if you're a weirdo and you're trying to convince people of your idea, you kind of have to go along with the game plan for a little while. Like, you know, this from starting a new job, you know, maybe you want to change things up. You kind of have to, you know, the first few meetings, the first few months, you have to be like, oh yeah, boss, like everything you're saying sounds amazing. I wouldn't change a thing. And then slowly over time, you start to introduce your like, hey, maybe we can have meeting free Fridays, and like, hey, maybe we can like, you know, whatever, other changes you might want to make. You kind of have to like, it's, you know, it's not that exciting, I guess, but it's kind of like going along to get along.
Got to conform for a little while, kind of suck it up and conform.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it worked for Beverly. I mean, well, at least in a sense. I mean, what's your conclusion on her story and the lesson we can draw from it here? That it works?
Yeah, I mean, for her, it really did work. Like, she started to have a lot more success with her class. And this is you can probably think of a million different examples of this, but, like, one example that I found in the research is the Beatles, actually, who started out writing, like, kind of cheesy love songs. Not cheesy, I mean, whatever, they're the Beatles. But, you know, they were kind of more predictable, like, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Love Me Do. And then as they, you know, became more famous, and they got weirder. Like, they started, you know, the songs on Revolver are just, like, way out there, and none of them are love songs. And, you know, there's, like, one song that I found on the White Album called Revolution 9, which is just a sound collage of the words number 9, which is it's very weird. But people were like, oh, yeah, I'm into this because it's the Beatles, right? But if they had gone out of the gate with that, they wouldn't have, you know, been as successful, I think.
Well, actually, the story of the Beatles kind of blew me away, I have to admit, because, first of all, some of the data is really interesting. Something like 75% to 85% of their songs when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show and in that era of, you know, the bubblegum pop and wearing suits on stage and, you know, sort of the teeny bop of the era, 75% to 85% of their songs were about love. And then, you know, their later albums in their 6 to 7 year run, it was like 15% were about love. They were writing about whatever they wanted. They were being as strange as they wanted, weird as they wanted, let's put it that way. But yeah, the narrative, Olga, on the Beatles is that they started off as these guys with these perfect haircuts and wore suits and very clean and acceptable and attractive and shaven and all this stuff, like no beards, no facial hair, nothing different. And then as they became more successful, they decided to kind of get weird a little bit. But they had to sort of be pushed to be that version of themselves on the Ed Sullivan Show. In other words, they had to use idiosyncrasy credits, because if they had their way in the late 50s, they would have tried to be weird out of the gate, and it might not have worked, it sounds like. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think, like, everyone knows that initial image of the Beatles of them being really clean cut, but that was actually not their natural state. They were like, so most performers who were, you know, popular in the UK at the time were very kind of clean cut, but the Beatles were actually kind of a raucous band who they would perform in Hamburg and they would scream things at the crowd and like call them Nazis and stuff. Like they were like kind of aggro, I'd say. and so their manager was like, hey guys, like I can make something of you, but you have to kind of like, you know, fit the bill, basically.
Tone it down.
So he basically was like, you have to wear suits. You can't wear leather jackets anymore. You have to comb your hair all the same way. Ringo had to shave off his beard, which I thought was funny. So they were sort of made into this like kind of clean cut boy band. And then they kind of like gradually like entropied their way back into weirdness as their career progressed.
I find that so interesting. And they finally had the capital to exchange to be as weird as they wanted to be, but they had to sort of earn it with these idiosyncrasy credits in the American and worldwide music scene. That is such an interesting story. And for listeners who are thinking, well, that is not how the world should work. You should not have to conform, whether you're in a job, whether you're in a friends group. You shouldn't have to go along. You know, Beverly, the teacher, shouldn't have to, quote, meet the students where they are if they're expressing things that are phobic and bigoted. That you should be, even if you're different, you should be honest and blunt and be who you are. And it's interesting for people who would say they would never compromise because, as perhaps as Olga would say, if you think you would never conform and build idiosyncrasy credit, you've probably never been in a relationship.
Yeah. So one of my favorite interviews that I've done about the book so far is someone was like, yeah, this is exactly like dating, where at first you pretend like, you know, oh, I, you know, whatever. I love avocados too. And I love romantic comedies too. And then slowly the truth is revealed that you don't actually like that stuff at all.
You're on your best behavior. You're always, you know, everything's clean. Your car is clean for about 3 months. And then you go,
right. Yeah,
this is not who I cannot keep up the charade forever. I do not live in a museum. So that's a form of idiosyncrasy credit in a sense. So we've all sort of done it. But I do want to ask you if it is fair for people who are, I'm going to say more weird, because we're getting a lot of feedback already from listeners who are saying, well, everybody's weird. Everybody's weird in their own way. And I kind of think that that's true, but I kind of think it's not. I mean, I think what we're really talking about are people who are almost unique or really largely different against the norms of where they are. And I can understand people who think this is not fair to make people have to go through this, to conform even for a short amount of time. What do you think, Olga?
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand that. And I'm not saying that everyone has to do this or that, you know, that like, here's my like recipe for success. Like, it never fails. I'm giving ideas to people who have faced some of these issues because, you know, as your reader, your listeners are saying, you know, a lot of people have. You know, but there's also people in the book who like really don't conform at all. So the story immediately after that is about this woman who is Muslim, and she goes off to like a big party college, and you know, like she was not going to conform by like drinking and partying and whatnot. Like she was going to stick with her faith, and so she just became really comfortable with saying no and being like her own person and not going along with people and not going along with what the norms are. So there are different ways to go about this. I just think, you know, sometimes it's easier to conform if it doesn't go against your religion, you know, if it doesn't really betray who you are.
Right.
You know, it can get you where you want to be ultimately.
Yeah. And I didn't take it as a way of sort of saying be fake or just ingratiate yourself and then reveal who you are. Because I actually think that there is a form of, I think idiosyncrasy credits are a form of being intellectually generous with people and actually trying to understand where they are. I think too often we are in this disposition that says, I'm not really listening, I'm just waiting for my turn to speak here, and I'm going to hammer you with my ideas. Whereas if you actually try to think, even if you think of yourself as weird or different or with ideas that are outlandish to wherever you are, whether it's work or a social group, if you stop and at least listen and even try to conform, I guess, you will find yourself at least trying to better understand why someone believes that way or why the culture at work is the way it is, even if you don't agree. And I do think there is value there, Olga. You know, I mean, to at least know why the norms are the way they are, even if you want to change them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is like rapport building is like a big part of what Beverly does. Like, so she, you know, she will like talk about, she's from a blue collar background. So she's not, someone who is from like a total, Ivy Tower. What is it called? Ivory Tower. Sorry. you know, she's not one of those people. And so she kind of really, you know, presents that to the class and makes sure that they, like, you know, that she can find commonality with them beyond just, you know, I'm a professor who teaches about these kind of weird things. And I think that'll get you far no matter what you're trying to do. And it's not like sleazy or smarmy to do that.
After our only break, I'm going to take Stephen Brighton on the phone, wants to share thoughts about his views of his own weirdness. And I'm going to read some emails from some listeners. Some of it's tough. I mean, people really sharing some difficult experiences. But also, before the hour's up here with Olga, I want to talk about the challenge of changing the world, I think, for the better when you are technically or probably socially weird or adopting ideas, viewpoints that are weird, when the norms are so strong, when you're in a tight society and the norms are so strong, how difficult it can be to get that to change. Also, if you're the kind of person who thinks, well, that's me, I'm weird, and I'm very free with it, I don't judge others, maybe we all have a little bit of Annette Kellerman in us, and I thought that story of the limits of how far we want to go is an instructive one. So we'll talk about that and more with Olga Hazan, who's a staff writer for The Atlantic and author of Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, we talk to those who have been on the fence about getting vaccinated. All adults have had the chance now to get vaccinated anytime they want. You can walk into a wide range of places and get a vaccine. Sometimes you can get a gift for getting a vaccine. But many people have still been on the fence, and we're going to talk to those who have had to try to make up their minds about what swayed them one way or another, talking about vaccine hesitancy Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Stephen Brighton. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan, I think this is a great conversation. I want to read this book.
Get the book. Okay? It's great. Yep.
Yeah, I can't wait. I grew up in the South my whole life. Family's been there for hundreds of years, and politics changed, and I found myself at a very young age as a weirdo. You know, he likes black people. I went in the military. I hated it, and I said it. You don't do that, okay? And you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have this family there that I go to see, and I feel like they're treating me with kid gloves. I see they're careful about what they say around me. But most recently, a person from a small city adjacent to my little town told me he was in a conversation, and my name came up. And someone I don't know said, "Oh, I know who he is. He's that New York liberal." And so I've been reduced to a, you know, derogatory, at least.
A caricature, sure, yeah.
Yeah, a caricature. And so I go there and I walk into a restaurant and I see people just look at me with disdainment. They conform like nobody I have ever seen. I've lived all over the country and I certainly know what this young woman's talking about, and I relate to it, and I want to buy her book. Okay,
Steve, I think it's great. Hang there for 1 second, Olga. I mean, okay. you've probably heard a lot of stories like this already from readers, but how common is Steve's experience, Olga?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially with politics, it is such a polarized time, and I thought with I think it's going to take a while, even though Trump has sort of gone away for now, for people to kind of. You know, it was he kind of created this sense of like you're either on our team or not on our team. And I think it can be really tricky to cross those lines. And, you know, that's something Beverly and I talked about, too, is that she has friends in Wichita Falls. But, you know, some of them would kind of try to talk to her about stuff that they saw on Fox News that just wasn't true. And she really struggled with how do I maintain a friendship with this person when I really cannot relate to any of their viewpoints. You know, some of those people she had to take a break from.
Yeah, and so, Steve, you know, when I think about your description of yourself as weird, given your circumstances growing up, just about everybody who would consider themselves weird would not be weird if they were in a different place doing what they're doing, with the exception of maybe a woman who's a race car driver, as Olga writes about. I mean, I'm not sure there's a place where that would be more common. But there are, you know, so it's kind of the story of someone who's different in the context of their place. But it's also a question about how comfortable you are with it and what you do with that. Have you viewed it in your life, Steve, as a strength? Has it been difficult for you? And as you get older, are you more comfortable with that?
Well, first, I want to say this didn't really start with politics. This actually started for me with religion, which I sort of turned my back on at an early age. Mm-hmm. But as I get older, I absolutely don't care anymore. I wear it as a badge of honor when I go back. I'll walk into the local cafe, and there'll be six or eight men sitting there for their noonday or 2 o'clock in the afternoon coffee hour, and I'll walk in and I'll go, "Hey, isn't that Trump up such and such?" You know, and they'll look. And so I wouldn't have done that 10 years ago for the world. Now I just walk in and start it. Okay, I had a fellow in a restaurant, take a gun out and throw it on the table. And this is what I think of your ideas. It's just a strange thing. Okay.
Wow. Steve, thank you. As always, it's good to hear from you. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, I love your show. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Steve in Brighton, just sharing what I think is probably, you know, somewhat common. And so if you think about what Steve grew up with, you know, Olga, he said in his community, he had friends who were black. That was uncommon. For anyone who has ever been in, say, a family setting where maybe you've got a family setting or a group of friends and someone is telling a racist joke because they think it's safe, all of a sudden you're the weird person in the group because internally you're going, whoa, I don't know why you think this is cool with me. Why are you? But the social pressure to not push back can be strong. And, of course, I think it's, you know, there's something to the advantage of being a white person who says, well, it's hard not to push back. And I'm thinking of black listeners who are going, well, you damn well better. But I'm just pointing out the power of the norms, the power of sort of in-groups and expectations and the challenge of being weird in a spot like that because there's a social cost. And do you find, Olga, that gets easier usually when people get older, that there has to be sort of one moment of breaking out, or is there, you know, different ways that people kind of deal with that? Because Steve says for him, it's gotten easier as he's gotten older.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I learned when I was researching this is that, we have different personality traits, and the trait neuroticism actually goes down as you get older. And neuroticism, I mean, it sounds really bad, and like elements of it are really bad. It's sort of that rumination, worrying kind of feeling. And I wonder if as neuroticism goes down, if you start to worry less about what other people think of you. And that might be what's going on with this listener or, you know, with other people out there, is that you sort of start out feeling like, well, I can't push back on, you know, the racist joke. What if everyone yells at me? Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, you're maybe like, well, I don't care if everyone yells at me because I'm going to yell back, and, or, you know, I can take it, or, you know, I'm going to throw my gun on the table, you know, what have you, like, you know, so it could be that. Yeah, but this absolutely, I mean, this quandary has like sparked a million of those articles every year of like, I have to go hang out with my racist family on Thanksgiving, and how do I deal with all the arguments that are going to happen? And yeah, I mean, it's like a really difficult thing, and people can absolutely feel sucked into agreeing with things that they don't agree with.
Talking to Olga Hazan, staff writer for The Atlantic and author of the book Weird: The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. The story of Annette Kellerman was really interesting to me. 1907, you write that all Annette Kellerman wanted to do was swim freely, and the bathing suits that you described that women wore in 1907, I don't have a scholarly background in women's bathing suits. The way you described it surprised me. It sounded like women were wearing the equivalent of Snuggies, you know, when they had to swim, and she didn't want to do that. The first part that I thought was interesting was that she had the courage to basically say, nope, I'm going to wear something that's, you know, easier to swim in. But then, as time went on, how she ended up feeling about the bikini. Can you tell the story of Annette Kellerman?
Yeah. So Annette Kellerman is really interesting to me because she shows how like our social norms can be so rigid. It can really be completely inflexible. So she got in trouble for swimming in like basically like a short sleeve shirt attached to some pants as her bathing suit, which was like way more scandalous at the time than these like wool dresses that women would wear to swim in, I guess, with stockings and knitted caps with tassels and a bathing coat.
And a bathing coat.
Yeah, you're wearing basically like 80 pounds of clothing once it gets wet. So she got in trouble for like sort of saying, I'm not going to do this. This is ridiculous. But then later when the bikini came out, someone interviewed her because she became like this pioneer of women's swimming. And I think it was, I'm trying to think when this interview was. But she said the bikini shows too much. Only two women in a million can wear it. And it's a very big mistake to try. So it's like, she just got in trouble for that exact thing. And she's like, but actually like the social norm should stop changing with me. Like,
yeah, yeah.
That's like a pretty common sentiment, is like, well, like what I'm doing is fine, but no further. And I don't know. I just thought that was like a funny story.
Well, to me, the Annette Kellerman story is a good reminder just to ask yourself how much you really do prefer a loose society and how open-minded, at least for me, I am, because if she, of all people who pushed the boundaries of what was weird when it comes to women's bathing suits, then turned around and said, nope, that bikini is insane here. What are we doing? Then we probably all have a little bit of that in us where we think, oh, no, it's natural. It's good and moral to make the change that I am calling for, but my weirdness is where it stops. Your weirdness is a bridge too far. I just found that very instructive. And I suspect, Olga, it's more common in us than we think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can think of a lot of examples.
So on the story of how we make changes, whether it's an Annette Kellerman who is going to do what she thinks she should do and maybe not care as much about what society is saying or what the penalty would be, in some places the penalties are harder than others. I mean, Olga writes about a wide range of the kinds of social, societal, sometimes government penalties, sometimes work code penalties that we can pay. Some are stronger than others. And I do think the story of Jess Herbst is inspiring, because some people that you write about have not only a comfort with their weirdness, but a confidence to make change despite the potential cost. Can you tell the story a little bit about Jess Herbst?
Yeah, so Jess Herbst is the mayor of New Hope, yet another town in Texas. And she is transgender. And I think she became the first transgender officially mayor in Texas. I'm sorry, I would have to look that up again. But she wasn't elected. She sort of became the mayor because the previous mayor passed away. And so she actually ran for re-election. And the thing that she faced while she was running was that so many people in the area weren't familiar with transgender people. Like, they just didn't know about it, thought it was quote unquote weird. She really had a difficult time, and she actually lost her election. But even since then, she's been kind of advocating for transgender issues. She's taking leadership classes in order to try to, you know, become a leader after all. She testified when Texas was considering one of the transgender bathroom bills. She testified against that in Austin. So she has sort of used her presence and used her influence in order to help make things easier for other transgender people in Texas, which I thought was really inspiring, because she really did not have an easy time of it. And, you know, I could easily see her getting kind of frustrated and sour and being like, I'm moving to San Francisco, you know. But she's hanging in there. She's still on the New Hope branch.
Jess is one of several dozen people that Olga interviewed and profiled for the book Weird. And in our remaining minutes, let me just read a little bit more listener feedback. We've got so much here. Listener writes and says, in elementary school, I was mean to a lot because I wear orange glasses due to a visual impairment and other ADHD personality differences. Thus, I decided that if being, quote, normal meant being cruel or rejecting others and making them feel bad for what was no apparent or justifiable reason, then I never wanted anything to do with what was perceived as normal and would explicitly strive to seek out and accept those who are obviously different or weird to my view. However, because we are all different and weird to some degree relative to each other, this means making at least some effort to accept or at least understand the perspective of essentially any and everyone. I've got a small stack of emails that's kind of like this, that people really struggled at times with feeling sort of cast out in certain ways or being told that being different was a problem. And I would like, Olga, if you could, share maybe a hopeful view of why you view the word weird in such a positive way and the advantage it can have.
Yeah, the biggest advantage that I found of being weird is actually just creativity. And the fact that over and over again in studies, we see that people who are considered weird, who are told, like, by researchers in the study, you know, you've been cast out of the group, the group didn't want you. It actually, for whatever reason, can make you a lot more creative. It can help you see things that other people don't see. And it can help you kind of free your mind from some of the rules of society that don't need to be there. I think one of the researchers that I interviewed said something like, once you see that one rule can be broken, you start to see all the other rules that can go away. And I thought that was really inspiring. It's like, yeah, if you can wear orange glasses, like, what else is possible? Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think that's sort of my take home message for weirdos, is that, like, these mean things that people say to you, in order to try to make you conform, you don't have to take them to heart. You can kind of use them as fuel for being the kind of person that you want to be.
Let me squeeze in two more emails. Listener asked to remain anonymous and says, Evan, I'm non-binary, and before quarantine, I was at a college where it was normal to ask pronouns when you met someone. I was still weird, but not as weird as I am now that I've been living at home here in Rochester for the past year. I'm the only trans person I know here, and I'm often the only non-binary person in people's lives. I found it extremely hard to be back in a place where everyone is cisgender and still feel secure in my own identity. Even well-meaning people will mistakenly misgender me and remind me that I'm out of place. I really don't know how to deal with this, and I'm just kind of holding out till I can get back to school. Thank you for this show. And Travis writes to say, I've been made to feel weird throughout most of my life. I was raised by a willfully contrarian Gen X father, and that arrogance has rubbed off on me. But despite being aware of this, I have niche interests. I don't drink or do drugs. I have a peculiar taste in women. I am very intolerant of repetition, and I am not a group culture type of person. I've struggled to conform to any job I've ever worked, no matter how hard I've tried, and whenever I'm usually let go, I'm told that I'm great to have around, but I'm just, quote, too much to keep employed. I've worked over a dozen jobs, and I have no idea how to fit in. That's from Travis. Final thoughts from you for Travis and from the listener who said, you know, I can't wait to get back to school just to kind of feel a little more comfortable in my space there, Olga?
Yeah, I mean, definitely my heart goes out to both of them, especially the student. I mean, I think that's like a, you know, I write about this, but I think that's a big kind of case to be made for, especially in those formative years of being around people who will at least support your identity, if not, you know, reflect it completely. People who will at least be aware of your differences and be respectful of them. I mean, the person who is, quote unquote, too much, like, it sounds like a real entrepreneur. Like, I wonder if, Elon Musk, got that a lot. if he ever tried to work a normal job. But you often see that. I feel like the people who succeed at kind of unconventional jobs or who become entrepreneurs are the people who people were like, actually, you're not very good at being just an office drone.
Yeah, and it is interesting. I think of Tony Colon over at Fuego Coffee in Rochester, one of the really interesting people in this town, who's talked about how he was viewed as sort of non-conforming to what school demanded and was told you're not going to succeed. He's carved it out for himself, and maybe Travis can take the lesson Olga just talked about and maybe find space for yourself. I mean, I don't want to make it sound glib or easy, but good luck to you, Travis, and I hope that you find strength in being weird. And Olga Hazan, the book is Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. It is wonderful, it's important, and I hope people pick it up. Thanks for taking time for the program today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
And not only the book, but you can find Olga's work in The Atlantic. She's a staff writer there. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Emma Ray Stein, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Wherever you are, have a great afternoon, and let's talk tomorrow on member-supported public radio.